This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we go back 3 years to when SWAT teams and 700 NYPD officers raided the Eastchester Gardens public housing project. What really happened during the Bronx 120 raids? Professor Babe Howell details the travesties of justice in her new report. Every day, U.S. consumers pay sales tax on thousands of personal health and hygiene products. But can sales tax unfairly burden women? Today's guest, Jennifer Weiss-Wolf, explains how taxing feminine hygiene products does just that. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. 3 years ago, on April 27th, 2016, SWAT teams and about 700 NYPD officers, along with federal law enforcement, raided the Eastchester Gardens public housing project and nearby homes in the Bronx. 120 people, almost all young and Latino men, were arrested and indicted after the pre-dawn raid. Prosecutors called it, quote, the largest gang takedown in New York City history. At the time, we covered it on Law and Disorder. Preet Bharara, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of New York, then, said the 120 were members of two violent rival street gangs that had, quote, wreaked havoc in the neighborhood for years and were responsible for at least 8 murders. The NYPD commissioner at the time, Bill Bratton, said, quote, these gang members do not belong on our streets. Instead, they belong exactly where they're going, to federal prison for many years, where they won't be surrounded by their buddies, they won't be close to their families, and they will no longer be free to terrorize the neighborhoods in which they grew up. Although the media covered the raids for a few days after, over the past 3 years, few journalists have actually followed up on the story. A new report, published prior to the raid's third anniversary, reveals troubling facts about the prosecution. It also raises questions about due process, the abuse of federal conspiracy charges, and the criminalization of social relationships in communities of color. Joining us in the studio today is Babe Howell, a co-author of the report and a professor at CUNY School of Law. Professor Howell studies gang policing practices and teaches criminal law, criminal trial advocacy, and lawyering skills. Professor Babe Howell, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Now, you've done a lot of research about gangs. Let's briefly talk about gangs for a minute. What are some of the biggest misconceptions about gangs?
The biggest misconceptions about gangs are essentially based on the myths that we see in the media, that they are highly organized, that they're shot callers, that joining and quitting a gang involves definite acts of violence.
Like initiation.
Like initiation. You know, and if you pay attention to the world around us, you might say, well, if you have to shoot or slash someone every time you join a gang, and we have thousands of gangs and hundreds of thousands of gang members, where are all those victims? Crime is at all-time lows. So the mythology of organized gangs that are primarily violent is just incorrect. The number one reason kids join gangs is for, two top choices. One is for belonging, a sense of family, and the other is for protection. You know, often kids who are getting bullied will join a clique or a crew, and that provides protection. The number one reason people leave gangs is because of violence. So, you know, gang membership is more about belonging, hanging out, maybe smoking weed, maybe making rap videos, but having a peer group, like joining a fraternity at college.
But of course, for the media, just the name gangs has a sort of cachet that I guess makes good headlines.
Absolutely. And when I first started working on these issues, when I first started looking into gang allegations, I was concerned that there was a reality there that I was missing, because I'd focused on broken windows policing, stop and frisk, low-level policing. But what I learned was that the police across the country are certifying people as gang members based on appearances, associations, photographs. No criminality is required, much less any violence. So, and those lists are secret, so there's no challenging them.
Well, I was actually going to ask you, do police departments keep lists or registries of so-called suspected gang members?
They keep registries of people that they say are certified gang members and associates, and they are generally secret. California requires notice, but most of the police departments violate that rule according to a California state audit. New York, the New York gang database has, according to the NYPD, about 18,000 names in them, and 98.9% of those are non-white. So we have a massive gang database with criteria that does not require criminality, and there's no judicial review notice to individuals. So the gang database is a big black box that includes whoever the police want to include on a list.
Now, if there's a routine traffic stop, for example, does a name of someone on in the database come up if someone is stopped and a check is done?
Unfortunately, it does. The NYPD recently testified at hearings at City Hall, and they confirmed that every patrol officer who's pulling up a name will see if someone's identified as a gang member, and that makes every interaction with an alleged gang member much more dangerous for that individual and for the police.
Because the police sort of gets their dander up and may be more prone to react quickly or use violence, I would imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've worked with a lot of affected communities, and individuals who say, I'm in a gang database, are very fearful of being stopped by police, especially if they have children in the car, and they do not purge these lists. So you'll have 40 and 50-year-olds who are in gang databases.
Well, you mentioned some figures in New York City. Does law enforcement deem gangs a serious problem? After all, isn't our rate of overall violence down in the metropolitan area?
So this is an interesting story of what sociologists would call moral panic. In 2012, in September, October 2012, then Police Commissioner Ray Kelly announced Operation Crew Cut. At that time, he announced that crews, small groups of young black and brown men, were the number one drivers of violent crime in New York. This despite the fact that our crime rates are at all-time lows. Why did he make that announcement at that point in time? It's my belief that because every mayoral candidate was running against stop and frisk, because the class had just been certified in the stop and frisk class action case, that the police knew the writing was on the wall. We can't stop and frisk black and brown men with impunity. We will now start surveilling them on social media. We'll start debriefing them about gang matters and talking to them about it, but not call it stop and frisk. So is it a big problem? No. I've made Freedom of Information Law request about NYPD gang stats, which they keep, as well as Comstat, and was finding that, you know, gang-motivated crimes are minuscule compared to the overall gang problem. You know, less than 2% of all crime in New York is gang-motivated, a slightly higher percent of shootings and homicides, but it's still in the, you know, 85-90% of shootings and homicides are not gang-motivated.
So let's go to the raids of 2016. In the East Chester Gardens Public Housing Project, the so-called Bronx 120, and the subject of your excellent report. That did receive great media attention. There were an enormous number of police officers. I understand about 700 NYPD, as well as there were SWAT teams and some federal law enforcement present. That accomplished the goal of drawing attention to that and perhaps deflecting it from what the police would say were curbs on their ability to do stop and frisk and, you know, do law enforcement the way they had traditionally done it. Do you think that was in a way sacrificing the lives of over 100 young men and their families and the community there just to prove a point?
Absolutely. Unfortunately, the Bronx 120 raids, which involved 700 law enforcement, ATF, FBI, Homeland Security, NYPD, SWAT teams, helicopters, pre-dawn, breaking down doors and then making whole families crawl on the floor with armed officers in their home in riot gear. That was unnecessary. It was deeply traumatizing for the community, and it was not justified by the actual charges and actual conduct alleged in the Bronx 120 indictments. Now, that's something that I did not know for sure at the time. I suspected it because I'd studied what are gang allegations, and I knew they didn't require criminality. But I wasn't sure, like, was this a gang war that I was unaware of? Was the violence that which was kind of represented at the initial press conferences, saying these were the two violent gangs who had turned this area into a war zone? In the last 3 years, I've looked at all the sentencing memorandums, the plea agreements, the transcripts, and the actual allegations against the defendants, and I found that half of them are not even alleged to be in the two so-called violent crews. Half. That's 60. That's dozens of individuals from this community. Two-thirds of them not alleged to have engaged in any violence. Only 18% of the defendants had a gun charge, about 5% murder. What we were doing, we're picking up, 20 individuals, 19 of whom had nothing to do with a homicide and one of whom did, and wrapping them all into a big case. They were routinely denied bail and they were prejudged as guilty and violent. And that really deprived them all of a fair trial.
Guilt by association, in effect.
Absolutely.
Were they originally charged with under the RICO Act? And if so, can you briefly explain how that worked?
Right. There were four charges. One of them was a RICO conspiracy, which is the Racketeering Influence Corrupt Organization Act, which originally was designed to get at informal associations like the mafia, highly organized criminal enterprises that infiltrated the legitimate economy, but that could theoretically run circles around federal prosecutors because of all the resources. Here, we're taking that same construct. We can criminalize even the conduct of an informal association, like a bunch of kids who form a neighborhood clique or crew. We can take that, and that will be the criminal enterprise and the informal association, and then we can charge everyone who's involved with that crew, who advances its interest in any way, like, Facebook posts and rap videos proclaiming what a great crew it is, or how they'll, kick your ass if you come to their neighborhood. I'm sorry if I'm not supposed to say that on radio. So they used RICO, which is four sophisticated criminal enterprises, against a group of kids who lived in public housing and in their mom's houses and had no resources. They all had assigned counsel for indigent defendants. There was no claim that they had money. In fact, the minimal fine of $100 was imposed on just about every case. I think one or two had $200 fines. So it's a misuse of this very broad statute, which has been misused similarly across the country in other gang cases. So this is not a new permutation. It's just pretty much the biggest that I'm aware of.
Now, I understand that with a RICO charge, and I'm sure that most of the attorneys that were assigned to these young persons, do a fine job, but a RICO charge is difficult to take through the courts. So let's talk about, were the charges reduced, and how many people took plea bargains?
So, as I mentioned, there was a RICO charge. There were two narcotics charges. One was a narcotics conspiracy, and a fourth charge, which was a gun charge. A gun either in furtherance of the RICO conspiracy or a gun in furtherance of the narcotics case. most of the defendants were required to plead guilty to one of those four charges. There were three declined prosecutions of the 120. Two were allowed misdemeanor pleas, but the rest took a plea to either RICO, narcotics, or the gun charge. And the prosecutors seemed to require the plea based on what they believe you did. So if Babe Howell was one of the 120 and they thought that I had possessed a gun and was selling narcotics, they would require me to take the gun enhancement and probably the narcotics charge and get the minimum, the mandatory minimum of 5 years if I had not used the gun and 7 years if I brandished it and 10 if I discharged it. So they really were tailoring to what they thought the individuals had done. But the really amazing thing was 35 of them pled to narcotics conspiracy involving just marijuana or RICO predicate acts involving marijuana. It's a little bit complicated, but 35 were just marijuana, 30 were just other drugs. So the vast majority had no violence and pled to the charge, but got a relatively low sentence. So you had 22 time served sentences, which were still average of 11 months. People were immediately held until they took the plea. And then we also had about a dozen sentences that were less than 2 years. So there were quite a few low sentences and pleas that show, wait, this is over-inclusive. We're not talking about violence. In many cases, we're not even talking about gang members. It was a prosecutor's submissions from which I got this person is not a gang member or is associated but not a gang member. So they did let people take pleas to lesser charges, but they did not plead down. They didn't give them misdemeanors. They didn't give them dismissals or deferred prosecutions.
They were all felonies.
Yes. They took 120 people. 80 of them had no prior felony conviction, and 115 were convicted of felonies. Two went to trial and were also convicted.
And what kind of evidence did they have? I mean, that is a lot of people to follow and gather the appropriate evidence to charge them with.
That's an interesting question. And it's a question that really came into focus for me when I said, wait a minute, you're going in front of the press, and there are ethical rules that say you shouldn't say these are 60 violent gang members if they're not. A prosecutor should not make those kind of comments that exaggerate the evidence and elicit public approbation. So I was very surprised that they were making these announcements and that the cases did not bear that out. My question was, are they misrepresenting up front, or does a prosecutor not know who they're charging or what specifically they did? And it seems to me that at some level they're in the second category with these kind of massive indictments relying on the NYPD to package a case to tell them who's who and who did what. And they don't seem to look into the evidence until you end up with the very stubborn ones who say, I'm not taking a plea, I'm going to trial, which is the minority.
Were there two individuals who went to trial?
There were two. One was a non-gang member who allegedly sold marijuana in a gang area. And the prosecution's theory was that he sold marijuana at a discount to gang members, which advanced the gang, and that he had to do that in order to have permission to sell there. They also had one gun charge on him, but the NYPD officer in the case, Jeremiah Williams, had substantiated IAB complaints, substantiated CCRB complaints, and 6-7 civil rights cases settled by the city of New York. So he had a really serious record of misconduct and, in fact, had broken Carlito Allen, the defendant's wrist in this arrest. And there were allegations on the defendant's part that it was not his gun, that, in fact, the other kid in the car had this gun. So it was really, in one case, I believe if you tried this case to a regular jury, absent the this is a terrible gang and this is the whole neighborhood, that he might very well have gotten acquitted. And then the second defendant who went to trial was alleged to be a gang member and was actually accused of murder. But there, too, the evidence was incredibly weak. The only person who said, like, I saw him shoot this other person was a cooperator. And it wasn't even clear that that person was at the party where the shooting actually happened. So the people who were at the party gave testimony that did not clearly identify this particular defendant. So really just worrisome cases where I think if you had the case in a regular, you know, I am just charging this defendant with murder, that you would likely come up with a not guilty.
Let's talk about your report. It's co-written with Priscilla Bustamante, and it's called Report on the Bronx 120 Mass Gang, in quotation marks, prosecution. When did you decide to write the report?
I think it was about a year after the takedown. I had been writing on gang databases and gang allegations and the exaggeration of the gang problem in New York. And someone asked me to analyze the many gang takedowns that have been taking place in the last 5 or 6 years. So instead of doing all of the takedowns, I decided to focus on one or two because it would have been pretty much impossible to get through all of them. But one thing I really would like to do as a follow-up is look at some of the smaller takedowns with a dozen or 20. I'm looking at one of those right now, and you see similar problems where individuals are included in the indictments that don't seem to belong in the indictments.
That leads me to this question. What does it mean to be, quote, associated with a gang? And is that a crime in and of itself?
What it means is a bit of a mystery. In fact, in at least one of these cases where the case that went to trial, Carlito Allen, they said he's associated with but not a member of. So honestly, that meant, you know, social network relationships in a photo here or there. They had one or two photos of him with one of the crew members. You know, it really just means, like, you know them. It doesn't mean you're a, you know, mini gang member or trying to get status. Is it a crime to be an associate of a gang member? No. And in fact, it's not a crime to be a gang member. There's a case, New Jersey v. Lanzetta, or Lanzetta v. New Jersey, I should remember which way those words go, that says it's not, you cannot criminalize merely being a gang member. You should have to prove that an individual committed particular crimes on particular dates with specificity in order to hold someone guilty and prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. What these conspiracy cases do and the gang cases do is they allow you to kind of prove that sometime in the last 5 years, Babe Howell, you know, sold marijuana in crew territory with their permission. It's almost impossible to defend that sort of, you know, I can't show that, oh, I was out of town that day because it's 5 years.
And we should also remind listeners that we're talking about pretty tight-knit communities to start with in some of the public housing projects. There's a chance that a lot of these, and I'm going to call them kids because quite honestly, if they were even in their early 20s, their minds haven't totally formed. But they see each other, they know each other by reputation or name, so it's kind of difficult, I would think, to make the differentiation between who knows each other and who just knows their neighbor.
Exactly. And going back to the myths about gang members that you started this conversation on, gang researchers find that there are wannabes, people who kind of pose, that there are situational gang members, the ones who come for the parties and disappear for the violence. Being a member of a crew or a gang does not mean engaging in any kind of criminality. It's not required. It is not the core of it. And many of these people, in fact, are not engaged in gang crime. And many of them do, you know, may get involved with a fight here or sell weed there. But most of that is just individually motivated. Most assaults are personal vendettas.
Let's talk about how these arrests impacted the lives of families from a low-income neighborhood. I actually spoke to a couple of mothers right after this happened and know how traumatizing it was. Was the whole process from the raid until final disposition kind of rigged against them, even on the issue of bail? Who was rooting for these kids?
Right. From day one, the process that was provided to the Bronx 120, and honestly, that's provided in any of these mass gang takedown cases, was the opposite of what should be expected. The kids were routinely held without any possibility of bail. And once again, we're talking about folks with no criminal history. Some of them had no misdemeanors. Most of them had no felony history. So they were held without bail. A few of them were released on consent of the prosecutor. Only four, I think, were allowed to be released over the prosecutorial objection. And those that were released, there were 19 of the 120, 15 of them had house arrest. So they couldn't go to their jobs. Even the ones who were released almost immediately, which would be 2-3 days, a week later, now had felony convictions over their head. They lost their jobs. People lose their home. People lose their children. The impact of this kind of pretrial detention and house arrest and electronic monitoring is enormous and essentially leads nearly every defendant to have to take a plea in order to get a date certain when they will have some freedom.
We don't have too much time left, but I wanted to mention one person, KL. There's a sort of sidebar in the report about KL. He had studied hard through college. He was a scholar athlete. Tell us briefly how this impacted KL.
I've appeared on radio shows with Craig Lewis, and I think he's very well willing to have his name revealed. He's in a documentary that's very, very powerful on the Bronx 120. But Craig Lewis was in his final semester of an MBA, just credits away from a graduate degree at Bridgeport. He'd lived out of town for years, and he was brought in and held for 22 months on these charges. Initially, the magistrate judge had granted bail, and then the prosecutor, the government, came in with wiretaps of one of his friends that really had a relatively innocuous conversation with the friend saying, you know, something about weed, and Craig saying, oh, it would be easy to sell an ounce in 5 minutes here. You know, really just minimal information that linked Craig to his childhood friends. And the impact, though, has been that he has not finished his MBA. He is making music, which is awesome, and people should definitely check out Craig's Instagram and his music career. And he's become a really great spokesperson for these issues. He testified recently at City Hall about how this destroyed his life. And certainly his six-year-old son, too, has been devastated. And he's one of the lucky ones, though. He got 22 months and a felony, although he had no record and was not a gang member. So the report and the data, which really excites me as a researcher, is all available at Bronx120.report, www.bronx120.report. And in the data, it's an Airtable data set. You can actually ask the data different questions. You want to know what happened to every 19-year-old who was indicted. What were their sentences, or what did they do? You can really play with it. So you should look at that. And there's also a lot of important research around gang databases and gang policing that's also available at that site.
And in your courses, you teach at CUNY. Does this factor into your curricula?
It has. I designed a CrimPro 2 course that was entirely around gang mass indictments, positing that the whole class was a resource center for attorneys in these cases, because the defense attorneys may have great expertise, but the discovery is huge. There's expert testimony that is anything but expert. There's so many issues and so much material that it's really difficult for an individual defender to get their head around it. And most institutional defenders, like legal aid and federal defenders, they are conflicted off the cases because they can't represent an individual defendant if they've ever represented any of the co-defendants. And if you arrest 120 people, then legal aid certainly will have, and any of them have prior histories and they're poor, legal aid or any defender office would have previously represented individuals.
And one final question, Professor Howell. What do you hope prosecutors might learn from this whole experience? Say they were to read your report, do you think they might do things differently going forward?
That's certainly the hope. I'm not sanguine. I fear these cases are incredibly easy to win. They generate very, very good press. The narrative that the prosecutor tells themselves is that they're protecting communities at risk. And because of the massive pressure to plead, there's very little counterfactual information that comes out. But I am hoping that they'll look at this case and say, wait a minute, we are relying on the law enforcement to tell us what the case is. We're relying on cooperators, and mostly the worst of the worst are getting excellent deals, and then everybody else is being forced to plead. We have a greater duty to exercise our discretion, to look at the evidence, and to really ask ourselves, should we be prosecuting gang members in any way that's different from any other criminal defendant? You know, how is it worse that a poor kid from the Bronx who grew up in foster care and who has a learning disability and who was hungry and sold marijuana to deal with that and joined a crew because he was getting bullied, how is that worse than a Epstein with all the money in the world committing serious crime? The gang narrative, the gang label is a shortcut, an end run around due process, around the proof beyond a reasonable doubt that someone did a specific crime. It also allows re-prosecution for the same offense. And those are things that a prosecutor, if they look long and hard at their duty to serve justice, will hopefully say, this is not what I'm here for. I'm here, if we're identifying gangs and crews, like, I'm going to encourage the city to provide resources, to provide diversion, and I'm certainly not going to pick up people who have moved out and moved on and matured out of gangs or never had much relationship with them to be scooped up in these cases. And more importantly, I talk a lot about the non-gang members and the marijuana cases, etc., but even the most seriously involved defendants in these cases deserve the same due process, the same criminal protections as any other defendant. And winning a case without those protections is not winning, it's undermining our whole criminal justice system.
Professor Babe Howell has been our guest. Her report, written with Priscilla Bustamante, April 2019, is called Report on the Bronx 120 Mass Gang Prosecution. The website bronx120.report. This has really been eye-opening for us. I know our listeners will appreciate hearing 3 years later on something that we reported. And kudos to you for this impressive report and mass amount of research.
And thanks so much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. Thousands of health and personal care items in the United States are exempt from sales tax. That includes items like shampoo, chapstick, and Viagra. Notably missing from that list are menstrual products. To date, only 9 states include sanitary pads and tampons from their tax-exempt list. 7 more have introduced legislation aimed at doing the same. 3 of the 7, Nebraska, Virginia, and Arizona, introduced their legislation this year. In her book, Periods Gone Public, Jennifer Weiss-Wolf chronicles what she calls a lack of period equity. She writes that managing menstruation is a critical aspect of the lives and civic participation of more than half the population and should be considered when making policy. While there is no specific tax on tampons, in states that don't tax medical and health supplies, tampons and sanitary pads are excluded from those tax-exempt categories. Joining us today to discuss period equity is Jennifer Weiss-Wolf, a leading voice for equitable menstrual policy in the United States. Her 2000 book, Periods Gone Public, lays out a proactive policy agenda. A frequent contributor to the New York Times, The Nation, Time, Newsweek, and many other publications, she's also on the advisory board of the Zana Africa Foundation, which provides menstrual health education and products to girls in Kenya. An attorney with expertise in nonprofit management and development, she is a vice president of the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. Jennifer Weiss-Wolf, welcome to Law and Disorder. Jennifer Weiss-Wolf, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jennifer, you're an attorney, and I'm curious how you became interested in the issue of so-called period equity.
Yes, it's not exactly the thing I think most people go to law school thinking that they're going to focus on. I've been working here at the Brennan Center for Justice, which is a think tank affiliated with NYU School of Law for about the past 10 years, and really by day focusing on core issues of democracy and justice and systemic change. And having nothing to do with menstruation. But a couple of years ago, January 1st, 2015, to be precise, I became aware through a Facebook post that was put up by a local mom in my community that she and her 2 daughters were collecting in tampons and pads for our local food pantry. And with that simple post and a quick response that I was very, very glad to contribute to their donation drive, I started really kind of, you know, wrapping my head around this question. Why would it be that something that is completely normal for half the population for a good percentage of their lives would be so, would be excluded from something as simple as funding or requirements for food pantry distribution, and that it would have to rely on kids doing product donation drives. And as I started really, you know, looking into this, what did it mean to have menstruation included or excluded from the policies by which we live, I found out that, you know, I guess not surprisingly, that menstruation is pretty well excluded or not considered or not even acknowledged in the vast majority of laws by which we live. And so with, you know, sort of a very Brennan Center focused, you know, theme, I really started to think about what our laws and policies would look like if they did acknowledge menstruation and the reality that half of the people who live by those laws have bodies that menstruate, and how we could ensure that lack of ability to afford menstrual products or lack of information about menstruation wasn't holding anybody back.
Jennifer, I was surprised to learn that so many personal health care products are taxed, but it seems to be a random way. So I'm sure you get this question all the time. Why are menstrual products like sanitary napkins and tampons taxed when something like Viagra is not?
Well, so there's sales taxes is actually a ridiculously complicated scenario. We have 50 states who each levy their own sales tax and have different rules that they follow. And then that doesn't even count when municipalities or counties have additional rules or taxes, sales taxes that are collected. So there's almost no uniformity across the country. Some of the things that are very common, though, are that states that collect sales tax will often exempt food and prescription medication from sales tax. Not all of them even do that, but many of them will, because they are deemed things that are necessary, or necessities of life. And, you know, people will talk about luxuries, not whether luxuries are taxed or not, and I'll just offer a quick point of clarification that we do not have any vocabulary describing a luxury tax when it comes to sales tax here in the United States. So it's not that something's considered a luxury and something's considered a necessity. It's just that necessities are often exempt from sales tax while other items are not. So menstrual products are not medical items. They're not prescription medications, and they're not food. So they often find themselves in the camp of sales taxed items. They don't qualify for exemptions as a food or prescription medication. But the thing that starts to become sort of inconsistent in this analysis is that there are a lot of items that fall under the category of food and prescription medication that are hardly deemed necessities. So under food, you might find things like fruit roll-ups or Pop-Tarts or barbecued sunflower seeds, all of which have been called out for sales tax exemptions. And then Viagra, the item that you questioned, you know, it's a great soundbite, certainly when you're trying to argue the case of gender or gender discrimination in our sales tax code as well. But Viagra is actually sales tax exempt because it's a prescription medication.
Right. Yeah, I realized that after.
But that doesn't stop it from being sort of a useful soundbite and an interesting question for people to ponder. Who's making these rules, and whose needs are they considering when they do so? And what do they deem, you know, normal when they do so? Or what do they deem sympathetic when they do so? So when you have, you know, many legislatures which have historically been male-dominated, it might not be a surprise to think that nobody ever stopped to think about menstrual products.
Jennifer, what is the so-called pink tax? Is that a separate issue?
So the pink tax is a broad sort of umbrella term for a consumer issue that when companies target or promote items that are gender-specific, that they charge more for the products that women are most likely to buy. So oftentimes that's done simply by changing the color or the branding or the packaging of the item. Pink razors will often cost more than blue razors. Pink bicycles will cost more than red bicycles. But then that also actually goes a lot deeper to whether it's clothing items, dry cleaning bills, all the way to mortgages and small business loans. And there, study after study, usually issued by the government, including one by the Office of Government Accountability in 2018, demonstrate that there is pervasive gender bias and outcome for women paying more for the same items than men simply because of how they're marketed. So that's the pink tax, or what's commonly called the pink tax. The tampon tax, which is different, and that's that states are not exempting or choosing not to exempt menstrual products from sales tax because they're not deeming them a necessity. People often talk about the two in the same breath, but are actually charged more or pay more to get by in daily life.
You mentioned dry cleaning a few minutes ago, and I remember years ago reading an analysis of how you bring a button-down men's shirt to the dry cleaner, and it's significantly lower in charge than a woman bringing in a similar shirt.
Yeah, it's a really insidious practice. And, you know, it sounds small when you think of any of these things as a one-off. People will say to me, you know, find a bigger problem to focus on. But when you put this in the context of our entire policy infrastructure, and you realize that sort of every rule by which we live, and every chance that there is to make things equitable for all, that women are sort of always on the losing end of that stick, whether it's from pay equity to what they're, you know, to the costs of living. And you actually have a systemic issue where women are not getting ahead and being held back for this giant array of inequities. So I would put that in that camp and say, my gosh, these are actually are kind of small when you look at them one-on-one. Shouldn't we be able to solve those?
How many states have gotten rid of taxes on feminine hygiene products?
So the current count for states that are exempting menstrual products from sales tax is 16. Back when I started this campaign in the end of 2015, in the lead up to the 2016 legislative session, 40 of the 50 states were still taxing menstrual products. And of the 10 that did not, 5 just have no sales tax at all, so therefore menstrual products had no sales tax either. And then 5 just included them in some sort of broader umbrella category, but had never specifically considered them. So this advocacy started with a 40-state count, and then since then, over 4 legislative sessions, 2016 through 2019, 6 states have gotten it done, which is actually, you know, remarkably fast progress for an issue that, you know, otherwise had, you know, maybe a bit of an ick factor to it, or had certainly never really seen the light of day, the idea of menstruation as a policy matter, or the economics of menstruation as a policy matter. So in total, 32 states have introduced bills since 2016, and as I said, 6 have gotten it done bipartisan, with an equal showing from Republicans and Democrats in terms of sponsors of bills, in terms of governors who've signed bills that have passed. So New York and Illinois were the first two in 2016, and New York with a Democratic governor and Illinois with a Republican governor, followed by Florida in 2017 with a Republican governor, and then Connecticut thereafter. And in November of 2018, last fall, on Election Day, the citizens of Nevada went to the polls and voted on a ballot measure to eliminate the tampon tax, and that passed, you know, with support across the aisle. And then most recently, on July 5th, over the holiday weekend, the state of Rhode Island, the governor signed its budget, and it includes a provision to eliminate the sales tax on menstrual products effective October 1st of this year. And it doesn't have a time limit on it, so effectively the tampon tax has been eliminated in Rhode Island. And then I should add that the state of California passed a temporary reprieve on the tampon tax this year in its state budget, but it's designated to only last for 2 years, till 2022. So they're going to have to do it all over again if they want to make that permanent.
And I understand that California may lose $20 million in revenue because of that. Are we talking about big money? Is that accurate?
Well, that's accurate, although I might reframe the way I would state that. They're not going to lose $20 million in revenue. They're going to have to find a more equitable way to ensure that their revenues are met, not on the backs of women. But yes, the menstrual product sales tax number comes to $20 million in California out of, I'm sure, a much bigger billion-dollar state budget. For most states, the revenues represented by the sales tax on menstrual products isn't a tremendous part of their budget. I mean, you have to put that into the context of what California state budget is. But my response to it, of course, is that there are more equitable ways to generate that revenue that's needed for the state. California is welcome to tax fruit roll-ups, or Viagra, or Pop-Tarts, or lattes, or any of the other items that are much less necessary that aren't only used by half the population.
In the New York Times, there was an article titled "Study Finds Menstrual Cups as Safe as Pads or Tampons," and that is a device somewhat like a diaphragm that is reusable. And there's something I wanted to read in the article. It says, for low-income women who experience so-called period poverty and are unable to afford sanitary products when needed, the cup can be a lifesaver. And that dovetails with how you began this segment, the moving story you gave about seeking donations of sanitary napkins. Are there women in the United States who are simply going without because they cannot afford these products?
Yeah, I mean, all of the anecdotal evidence that has been collected by myself and others in this movement, the answer is yes. And that lack of ability to afford menstrual products or access them when needed, and that doesn't just include for people who are low income or experiencing homelessness, but people who are incarcerated or in the custody of the state, who don't have, you know, the agency to be able to get what they need when they need it, that lack of access for menstrual products is indeed a problem. And you know, that's a terrific article I'd actually talked with a New York Times reporter about that piece. And what we talked about as well is that for many, it's true that having a reusable product and not having to incur the cost month after month, that is an extraordinary benefit. But menstrual cups are also just not a realistic product that everybody can use. One has to have access to a private bathroom. One has to have access to hot running water to be able to clean it and ensure that they're using it safely. Honestly, one has to have a decent education about menstruation to know how to use it properly. So there's a lot to it, and it's not so simple to say that, you know, people who are experiencing what's called period poverty, that all their problems would be solved, or at least their menstrual problems or menstrual access would be solved by having a menstrual cup. For many, that would be a godsend. For many, it just might not be feasible.
That's disturbing what you mentioned about women in prison, that they're not just given sanitary products. They have to pay for them.
Well, it's worse than that. Sometimes they do have to pay for them if they have the ability to access the commissary and if they have the funds to do so, which, of course, as you can imagine, many don't. The prices are jacked up, and we're talking about people who are largely impoverished anyway, or if they're, you know, even participating in any work program while incarcerated or making, you know, pennies for the hour. But menstrual products are by law in many states now, and again, due to this advocacy, as well as in the federal system, a law was passed by the 115th Congress and signed, in fact, by President Trump that mandates the provision of menstrual products in federal prisons. But even laws that mandate the provision of menstrual products don't get at the fact that, you know, that has to be enforced fairly, that there's often a tremendous power imbalance, that exists between people who work in the facilities and people who are incarcerated. So even if by law the facility has to require them and a person doesn't have to go to the commissary to buy them, that presupposes that the staff there are going to distribute it fairly, equitably, kindly, in a dignified way. And testimony after testimony that I've heard in research that I've done for my book and other advocacy has women have shared stories about guards taunting them, teasing them, you know, threatening them, asking them to trade the menstrual products for other things that they have of value to the guards, that it's an extremely degrading and undignified circumstance to be in.
Is the embarrassment factor a component in the success or lack of success in advocating for changes in the tax laws for feminine hygiene products?
Yes and no. I think that for a long time, this issue had been completely out of the public sphere, and the stigma factor is surely part of that. Menstruation just isn't something that people tend to talk freely about. You know, when I heard this issue in 2015, the very first thing I did was write an op-ed about it and really sort of forced public conversation. That piece was published in the New York Times in January 2015. And, you know, it was, for me, somebody who had never spoken publicly about menstruation or about the intersection of public policy and menstruation, it was a very, very public way to throw myself out there. As it happens, since this policy agenda has been introduced, starting in 2015 with tampon tax bills, and here in New York City where I am, were able to introduce, have public testimony on and pass in a very short amount of time, the first menstrual access laws in this country, whereby New York City mandated the provision of tampons and pads in all of the city's public schools, shelters, and correction facilities back in 2016. That's the law here now. People were actually not embarrassed to talk about it, or maybe they were at first, but once they started to, you know, they discovered they weren't going to melt into the floor or it wasn't going to be a horrible experience. In fact, these laws have had a tremendous amount of traction and success in a very short amount of time.
I notice that you're on the board of the Zana Africa Foundation, which provides menstrual health education and products to girls in Kenya. Can you briefly talk about that effort?
Yeah, so Zana Africa is a wonderful organization, and I had the great pleasure to meet with their founder and team you know, back in 2015, and they provide a combination of menstrual products that they are responsible for producing, as well as key menstrual information for teenagers and students in East Africa. And they're based in Nairobi, Kenya, and they do just extraordinary work. And I think that, you know, I've been largely focused on domestic policy here in the U.S.
Well, Jennifer, you're certainly an inspiring advocate. You became aware of this in 2015, and in 2 years, you'd written an extremely well-reviewed book, Periods Gone Public. What are your plans for the next couple of years?
Well, menstrual access and equity remains a huge priority for me. It sounds kind of weird, but it's kind of become my obsession. I'm really convinced that a lot of the challenges we face now in terms of gender equity here in the United States are rooted in asking ourselves questions like this. Why are we as women often left out of decision making, left out of policy, left out of, you know, what the rules by which we live are? We're not a special interest group. We're half the electorate. We're half of the population. So if these needs are being neglected, what else? Like, to me, it's kind of the gateway to that much broader question. But in terms of menstrual equity and access and the economics of menstruation, I have a nonprofit that I've created as well, under which I do this work. We've actually launched a major legal project focused on the sales tax question, and are going to be leveraging legal arguments using state and federal constitution under equal protection the clause. We're going to be exploring use of state equal rights amendments and other administrative rules to ensure that the 34 states that still have yet to stop taxing on menstrual products are actually forced by law to do so.
If our listeners are interested in this topic, and I'm sure at least half of them will be, how can they find out more about you, your writings, and maybe even this new organization?
We are absolutely open to citizen participation and engagement. This is a movement that requires all of our voices. So people can visit two different websites, periodequity.org, which is the website for my nonprofit, which is called Period Equity. And then we have a separate site called taxfreeperiod.com. That is the site for this new legal project.
Jennifer Weiss-Wolf, it has really been a pleasure to have you with us. We wish you the best of luck. We want to check in with you when more states have gotten rid of this tax. So thank you for your hard work.
You got it. Well, there will be lots of opportunity to do that. Thank you so much.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.